I open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on Monday, April 8th, 2013. I open up the work session on House Bill 3301. Representative Barnhart.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3301 has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. It authorizes the owner of a lot in a planned community or unit in condominium to install and use an electric vehicle charging station. Great.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Phil Barnhart. I'm the state representative from House District 11, and I was here for the public hearing. I wanted you to know that Representative Wisnant brought some issues to my attention, and those are reflected in the Dash 1 amendment that I hope you've got. The issue that the first issue that he raised was that there's nothing explicitly in the bill that required that the purpose of the charging station that we're requiring the homeowners association to allow an owner to install would be used for personal non-commercial use of the owner. If the amendment passes, then that language is inserted in the bill in the places where it would need to go. And then the other issue had to do with the ability to recover costs of the review and permitting of a charging station. I had to pay some building permits to the city of Portland in order to do this in my condominium in Portland. There's no problem with that. I thought it was already covered, but in the abundance of caution, we added that language also to the Dash 1 amendment. Otherwise, it's my view that this bill is ready to go. One final comment, if I may, and that is that this bill puts a very, very small sliver of requirement onto a homeowners association. It does not mean that they can't do a lot more by agreement. They can do a lot more by agreement. One of the associations raised with me the issue of, gee, what if we want to do some commercial? What if we want to allow an owner to have his renter use the facility? The answer to that question is there's nothing in the statute that prevents any of that. All this bill does is require that if the homeowner can meet the other requirements of the homeowners association, that they be allowed to make an installation and use it.
Great. Thank you very much, Representative. Any questions of this witness? All right. Seeing none. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments dated 4-5-13 to House Bill 3301.
Representative Gomberg moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated 4-5-13 to House Bill 3301. Any discussion? Any objection? If not, the amendment is adopted. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll then move to that House Bill 3301 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 3301 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Madam Chair, you may not want to answer this, but have you been invited to this condo or to ride in this electric car?
I have never.
I haven't either. I'm not going to withhold my support.
I'm shocked to learn this.
I am too. Thank you for asking that question. I hope the message gets out there. Thank you. Any other question or discussion? Then, Debbie, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Gallegos.
Aye.
Representative Gelser.
Excused.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Kingsgeier.
Aye.
Representative
Wisman. Excused.
Representative Wisman.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gomer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. The motion passes. Representative, would you carry the bill on the floor?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming today. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3301.
Tell he's lucky.
And we'll open up the public hearing. Let's see. I saw the good Representative Val Hoyle coming in. Are you coming in for 2205, ma'am?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. We will have open up the public hearing on House Bill 2205. Regina.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2205 has no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact. The statement has not yet been issued. It also has a Dash 5 amendment. It requires the Department of Human Services to adopt rules to ensure that investigations of abuse of vulnerable persons are conducted in uniform, objective, and thorough manner throughout the state. It directs DHS to prepare annual report to Legislative Assembly regarding reports and complaints complaint of abuse against vulnerable persons. It expands the crime of assault in third degree to include intentional physical injury to vulnerable person. It declares an emergency effective upon passage.
Thank you, Regina. Good representatives. And now to you all, or else we will not know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vic Gilliam, State Representative from District 18, along with...
Val Hoyle, Representative from House District 14, West Eugene, and Junction City. Very pleased to be speaking to you today. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for coming today.
Madam Chair, I have good news and bad news. The bad news is that I'm going to have to speak for a little while here at the beginning, and then I will stop. But we're going to do a little more than the normal sort of warm-up that representatives do from time to time, and try to give you a little background on this bill before the really interesting people come. So please bear with me, but we've got a PowerPoint. And I'm not running the PowerPoint, Representative Hoyle is.
I'll be running the PowerPoint to the best of my ability.
So
I notice there are, we have several amendments in our packet. Are you going to be addressing
the
one?
Thank you for asking.
Fives.
Dash five. Great. Thank you.
We are big on the fives, and we will walk you through those in this presentation.
Thank you.
And as you well know, Madam Chair, we've been working on this issue for some time, and this is the second on what I would say are two compatible bills regarding elder abuse prevention. So just to go backwards just for a moment, you'll see there was the original Adult Protective Services team under the leadership of Aaron Kelly Seal. That was convened largely because of our chair, Chair Tomei, and her concern for this issue. We went through that work group. We created the Elder Abuse Work Group that was charged with the definitions. Although we have definitions in statute, they are statute... Did I say
statutory?
Yes. They are inadequate, and it's one of the major reasons we needed to move forward with this bill so that the Oregon statute has elder abuse definitions. And that will continue in the bill that you see before you. Then it's always important, and you're going to enjoy hearing from a diverse group of stakeholders because we have buy-in from virtually every important stakeholder group in this state, both in the previous team and the one that that we've convened for this bill. And we're very proud of that, and you're going to hear from some of them in just a moment. And then in 2012, we introduced 4084. Thanks to the support of our chair and others, we received broad support, and the governor signed it into law. Just to quickly, I'm not going to read all of this. I'm just going to make sure you see these four bullet points about the previous bill, 4084. Increased time to prosecute crimes against seniors. Today, you're going to hear a great example of why this works. And the officer that's here that you've met before is going to talk to you a little bit about that. Second one is we eliminated the expungement for convictions of elder abuse. Then we provided vital tools for law enforcement during their investigations. And we also created the Resident Safety Review Council. We go right on to the next slide, Madam Chair. You'll see just a quick another summary of the Patient Review Council. Remember, this group was charged in the bill to do this definition work and to the four things that you see here on the slide. You heard their report from their good work in this committee on, I don't have it in front of me, do I? We heard it here. I don't remember. I'm looking for when they were here, just to remind the committee that they've already heard this report, and I can't find the date.
Previously.
Thank you. Oh, it was February 25th. It's right there. You were kind enough to have them come in and report their findings. You'll see they talked about developing an abuse definition algorithm, improving investigation and reporting technology. They emphasized definitions, and as hard of work as they did, basically what they were saying in the definitions is, we don't have them yet, and this is how you need to organize to get them, which is a very important part of the bill that you see before you, is moving forward in this definition issue. And then lastly, they talked about long-term care worker registry. This was an incredible amount of work, and yet we've got so much more to do. But these folks, as you remember, they were going through by boxes and boxes of old reports just trying to narrow some of this down for the summary that you see in front of you right now. And again, our thanks to the folks who worked on that. Bethany Walmsley gave that report here. Mary Yeager, you all know from the Ombudsman's Office. John Wentworth is here. He's the senior DA from Clackamas County. Madam Chair, our county, you know him. Diane Richardson and Demi Haffenreffer were all, Fred Steele also from the department. So, today, I wanted to make sure you had that background, but colleagues, today you're looking at 2205, and again, we're focusing on the Dash 5s, because we want to continue the work of that Patient Safety Review Council that we just discussed, and we want to make sure that we continue a very good relationship of working collaboratively with diverse stakeholders so that we positively impact abuse investigation in our state. And I'm very pleased that that's the direction that we think that these amendments to this bill will go. And I know you will interrupt me whenever you feel that.
Oh, you know I will.
Yeah. So, Dash 5, let's walk through those quickly. It removes the sunset provision on providing access to medical and financial health records. This is a very important point where we have, I believe sunsets can be extremely helpful, particularly in the first iteration of a bill. And now, with the success that we have and that you'll hear about, I think it's time to remove that sunset so that we have continuity in training and in moving forward with elder abuse investigations. That part, that part alone is going to save a lot of money on the banker's end. And by the way, bankers and credit unions have bought into the Dash 5, and you'll have some material. I don't think they're going to testify, Madam Chair, but to your preference, they've provided written testimony, which doesn't take as much time, and I'm going to the next one. Dash 5 amendments reflect agreed-upon language. This is really key. This shows you folks are working together. Notice, Criminal Defense Association and the district attorneys agreed on this language, which clarify the underlying report requirements that initiate prosecution under the extended statute of limitation period. Could you keep up, please? The Dash 5s bring the Elder Abuse Mandatory Reporter Statute in line with our child abuse reporting requirements, which has been one of our goals all along, is to at least bring elder abuse situation to the level that we've rightly attached to child abuse. So under this bill, we would become, by we I mean I'm looking at my panel and my committee, we'll become mandatory reporters along with our dentists, optometrists, chiropractors, and attorneys. I want to say something very quickly about attorneys without making any attorney jokes, Madam Chair. This is a huge group to include. But you'll notice that we allowed the CLE, and we never use acronyms in this. I don't know if you knew that, Madam Chair. This is the Continuing Learning Education Credit. We've been able to combine those credits so that we're not making it harder on our professionals in the attorney business, but actually allowing them to combine that with elder abuse training and child abuse training. Plus, you'll notice we've given them a generous amount of time for implementation. It wouldn't start until 2015. And I think my last slide about the amendments, maybe the second to the last, is the Dash 5s would extend the work group that the good representative and I have been trying to chair, but it's a pretty easy job because of the folks we have on that group, to 2015. And we're narrowing our objectives, and you'll see them there on that slide. I won't read them to you, but that's going to be the focus as we go forward with the work group. It's important to say at this juncture that the focus here is on elders. Do you have anything to add to that?
You have one more slide.
I have one more slide. Regarding, you remember we just heard on the floor a bill regarding, and discussed in this committee, obviously, the multidisciplinary teams, the MDT teams. And the language in the Dash 5s provides permissive language for DAs. So we are not laying this out as a mandate. We are simply saying the MDTs, multidisciplinary teams, are a wonderful model. But in this particular case, they will be able, if they want to pursue this, they will be able to utilize folks that are already approved for the team to do the administrative work that normally in the traditional model is done by the DAs. And you remember that was onerous to a lot of our rural counties. So we're giving them this option. This is very important that it's permissive. And that they would be able to work on elder or adult abuse issues under a more lax, if that's not the right word, but a permissive model.
Representative Delzer has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, and I just want to be clear, this would not make voluntary the multidisciplinary teams for adults with developmental disabilities that were part of 2442, and we extended that sunset on the House floor. This would leave those as mandatory and mandatory with district attorneys in every county of the state.
That is my understanding, although the additional work with elders for elder abuse would be permissive and not mandatory to work within the multidisciplinary teams. So it is my understanding that it does not in any way weaken the legislation that we passed previously.
Okay, and just one more follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And so what that did, it created these timelines for how quickly law enforcement needed to be called and when DAs needed to be contacted, and it mandated who is a member of that team and that it's chaired by the district attorney. That would remain in place.
Would remain in place, and what this does is just provides permissive languages for district attorneys to partner with current team members in the case of elder abuse investigation.
And Madam Chair, if I could add, I was just reminded the permissive language is specific to the administrative portion of this, so it does not change the original bill, and these are separate tracks. We are merely adding a model that they could use in administering the team's efforts as far as elder abuse goes.
So, as in follow up, as in terms of who it is that turns in the report, who it is that sends out the notifications, but the actual meeting and staffing of the MDT is not permissive or voluntary. That still takes place.
That is not addressed in this bill.
Okay.
At all, but it's a fair question.
Make sure I got it.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Whitson?
Yes. Since I wasn't here last year and some of us weren't, could you explain, on the last slide, you say team members will be allowed to partner with the district attorney. How many team members? One team member? You had a whole list of what were considered team members. So any one of those, two of those, three of those, all five of those?
Actually, previously, I think you may be thinking about the slide that had these people listed. Those are not team members.
No.
Those are mandatory reporters.
No, it was that one at the bottom, expands current membership to include. So is it any of those people? Are those?
No, that's just the elder abuse work group that we have put together to talk about elder abuse issues.
Okay.
So when we're talking about, the multidisciplinary team, that's completely separate. That just says if you're investigating, you know, you have law enforcement or health authorities investigating elder abuse, maybe community mental health worker, DHS, OHA, local agency on aging, law enforcement, or other adults, if they suspect that there's elder abuse and there is an investigation, then they are welcome to partner with an existing multidisciplinary team that already exists within a city, county, or state.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Is that it?
That's our presentation.
I have one more question about
yes,
the amendment.
Yes, Representative Gelser.
Thank you. So in the bill, in the -5 amendment, it says that it's repealing sections 25 and 29 of chapter 70 of 2012 and chapter section 43, chapter 837 of the 2009 Oregon laws. What is that that's being, because it doesn't outline the text, it just says those sections. What is that that's being repealed?
I
can't answer at this time.
Can't answer. We'll get you that information. I do believe that that has to do with who is a mandatory reporter and who would be included as a mandatory reporter and how that was written. I will. We'll get back to you by the end of the other testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just curious. As with child abuse, mandatory reporters, there's sanctions if you don't report. Will there be sanctions with this as well? Did I miss that?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gallegos. Yes, they would be the same sanctions.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your great work. You guys make a great team, along with your big coalition behind you. The 1 hour of CLE for child abuse and then adding elder abuse as part of that, was that thoroughly vetted with the child abuse community and the lawyers? Is there enough similarity that it doesn't take away from the learning that they would have had around child abuse?
Chair Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer, we had a lot of discussions with people about that. Actually, one of the longest discussions we had in our group was about who to include as a mandatory reporter. Are you actually taxing the system if you add more mandatory reporters? What's the appropriate way to get this information out? The Bar Association was included in our meetings and at the end felt that, or at least didn't say that they were uncomfortable, but in our discussions, it felt that that 1 hour training could adequately go over child and elder abuse, because although there are some differences, especially in terms of financial abuse that you don't generally find with children, there's a lot of similarities in the physical abuse issues.
Thank you.
Any more questions for this team? I know you've both worked really hard and long on this, and thank you for your attention to this.
It's really exciting to be able to do something that actually matters, and I think when you hear from the people that come up behind us and see the real-life impact of the bills, that the law that many of you voted on and allowed us to work on, it's just very tremendous and moving. So thank you for your assistance.
You're welcome.
Thank you again.
So we have a list of people. Matt Smith, Joe Greenman, and Mary Jaeger. And John Wentworth will have you after this team.
Certainly I can't.
Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Joe Greenman. I'm legal counsel with the Oregon Healthcare Association. We represent the long-term care facilities throughout the state, over 600 nursing facilities, assisted living, and residential care facilities. I'm happy to come before this committee today and indicate our support for House Bill 2205 with the -5 amendments. I'm going to specifically single out two sections of the bill that I'd just like to talk briefly about. First of all, Section 9 of the bill keeps the elder abuse work group in place for another increment or period of time to continue to work on one very specific issue that does need additional time, energy, and work focused on it, and that is the specific statutory definitions of what we call civil abuse, or the findings of abuse that the Department of Human Services imposes on providers of care when there is substandard care afforded to residents of those facilities. In the Resident Safety Review Council report, which was a product of House Bill 4084, the key findings of that report on page 7 in this particular area found that The abuse language is subject, the language of the abuse statute is subjective, and that is problematic for this particular regulatory activity of the Department of Human Services. That the process lacks an improvement and a prevention focus, and that finally the stigma of abuse is counterproductive. Specifically to that final point, as an attorney who represents facility providers, I can definitely underscore the fact that that stigma of a regulatory abuse finding, especially when you already have some subjective language issues, causes the providers to really dig in their heels and want to fight on those, especially the ones who are of a fervent belief that they're providing high-quality care for their residents. Because I have worked with members in the past who, because of issues pertaining to the care of a resident, but where there isn't the intentional act that you normally associate with abuse, there's an abuse, a regulatory abuse finding, and the instinct of good providers is to fight back, lawyer up, and really go through this process, and then that leads to, you know, a legal regulatory dispute with the Department of Human Services. So to the extent that we can have a work group put together with a vast, diverse array of stakeholders to look into this issue, to try to really get technical about the specific elements of the abuse definition, and also look at some things that are going on, and specifically in some other states, to try to bring in some prevention elements as well, I think will definitely be a positive step that can be taken. So that Section 9 piece and the additional stakeholders that are being brought into it are a positive change and a key element of why we support the legislation. And also, just to invoke a little bit of personal privilege, I indicated that I'm legal counsel, which means I'm a member of the bar, I'm an attorney, and I'm happy personally, as a member of the bar, and as somebody who works in issues that pertain to, services and care for elderly people, that we're bringing in the profession, the legal profession, and attorneys into that mandatory reporter piece for elder abuse. I know that from my experience, every 3 years, usually sometime right before my reporting deadline, I do that 1 hour child abuse reporting CLE, and I've often thought or wondered why we didn't have a similar CLE that was mandatory for all attorneys, so that they would get some indoctrination and some knowledge about the importance of recognizing and reporting elder abuse as well. So that's also a positive step. And so with that, I'll conclude my remarks. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee, my name is Matt Smith. I'm a detective with the Forest Grove Police Department. Very privileged to be serving on the work group with Representative Gilliam and Representative Boyle, and I'm here to speak to you today about some of the successes of this bill and some of the useful attributes that are in this bill and how important it is to a frontline law enforcement officer, specifically someone like myself who's investigating elder abuse cases right now. And one of the first points that I wanted to touch on is the importance of law enforcement being able to get access to medical records in a fairly quick time frame. It can seem counterintuitive when we're investigating a fraud case that we need access to medical records. But in many instances, our suspects who are perpetuating this elder abuse are caretakers or individuals who have assumed a role of trust or responsibility with a senior citizen. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard that these thousands of dollars in stolen money were gifts, they were loans, when come to find out this person had been suffering from dementia for years. And the only way to determine that is by being able to go back and speak to a primary care physician to determine when this diagnosis took place. And there were concerns initially when we talked about this that law enforcement would be going into doctor's offices and hauling out boxes of medical records, and that is simply not the case. What it has allowed is to put language into the statute, which has made physicians much more comfortable talking to us and cooperating with law enforcement when we suspect that one of their patients is being victimized. And the next step is, of course, once we can determine that somebody is mentally incapacitated due to dementia or some other sort of incapacitation, that there's an avenue for us to get access to medical records. And I have seen a progression even after the passage of House Bill 4084 that I'm receiving financial records in a matter of 10 to 14 days, where before it was 30 to 60 days. And to give you one example, as I'm just now going to trial on an elder abuse case from 2010. I'm going to grand jury on an elder abuse case probably in the next few weeks from 2011, even before the passage of this bill, where I used to chart elder abuse investigations and from the beginning of the investigation to adjudication in years. I can tell you that I see a future with this legislation where I might be able to see adjudication in less than a year, 6 months, 3 months. I'll be able to get these cases to a prosecutor much faster. And to give you one real-life example, I'm preparing for a trial this week. Tomorrow will be my first day. In the midst of preparation on Saturday, I discovered an $85,000 theft that I had mislooked, that I had not recognized what it was when reviewing my trial exhibits. And we're just barely within the statute of limitations on that, thanks to the provisions of House Bill 4084, and thanks to all the great work that all of you have done. And I'm confident that with the provisions of this bill, we'll be able to get this case presented to a grand jury in a timely manner and see some justice for this person. So I personally want to thank all of you for the opportunity to testify in front of you, and I'm going to go ahead and conclude my comments.
Thank you so much. Any questions of either of these, and we'll go on to Mary. Good job. Thank you for all the hard work you've done, too. Mary, welcome.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Mary Yeager, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. I'm now just starting my third year and eighth month as Ombudsman. Prior to that job, I spent 10 years working in child abuse and child abuse prevention in Multnomah County as the CASA Director for both Multnomah and Washington counties. So I bring a unique set of experiences, not only to my testimony today, but to the work I do with our Ombudsman volunteers. I would like to echo the first two speakers and say thank you for the considerations of the Dash 5 amendments. I worked on the committee. I worked on all the subcommittees. Both my staff and our over 200 volunteers are anxiously awaiting the opportunity for a clear elder abuse definition that we can share with consumers when they either call our 800 number or approach our volunteers in a wide variety of facilities across the state. So thank you for your consideration, and we're looking forward to the opportunity to help clarify definitions going forward if the Dash 5 amendments are approved. I'm happy to answer any questions, but thanks for considering.
Any questions? Thanks for all the work you do too, Mary. So for some people who are new to this committee, how often do people in long-term care get visitors, or how many people do not get visitors?
Chair and committee members, there are many people. When we talk about long-term care facilities, we're talking about nursing homes, community-based care, so assisted living and residential facilities, and then adult foster homes, many of whom are literally unbefriended. Many have no family, no social contacts, no neighbors, and literally that setting becomes their home and their community. So our volunteers also serve that purpose as being an extra pair of eyes and ears for the state of Oregon, and also being a good friendly face, checking in and making sure that all is well.
And how many counties do not have any long-term care ombudsman volunteers?
Chair Tomei and committee, we have, I believe, 4 counties that have no volunteers. However, we have some amazing volunteers who are willing to cross county borders, and particularly in eastern Oregon, are willing to drive 150, 175 miles one way to peek in on someone who's called with a situation or a problem.
Representative Gallegos.
I just want to thank the panel. You know, I mean, this issue is so critical, and thank the work group as well, and particularly with the baby boomers aging now. I mean, this is just going to become a more and more critical issue, so I really do thank you. And I just want to mention, Mary informed me the other day that she took a class from me. And
so I guess how did I do, teacher?
Yeah, I'm very proud of us both. Thank
how
you.
How did he do?
He was the best teacher ever.
Mary, I seem to remember that at one hearing you said that 60% of the people in long-term care facilities never get a visitor. Is that number
I would say
still
that
accurate?
That is, depending which level of care you're looking at and in what parts of the state. But if you think of so many folks who have literally no one,
yes.
I mean, that setting becomes their home. Their caregivers oftentimes become family, and the people who live with them are literally extended relatives. It really is their home and neighborhood.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Wentworth. Welcome, John. It's good to see you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Tomei, members of the committee, my name is John Wentworth. I'm a prosecutor with the Clackamas County District Attorney's Office. I'm a representative of the Oregon District Attorney's Association as well. I also have worked on the work group and from the beginning, and wanted to share some of my thoughts about the Dash 5 amendments. First of all, Representative Gelzer, you mentioned the MDTs, and that's an issue that's near and dear to my heart. Clackamas County, I'm proud to say, was one of the first counties to get on board and create our multidisciplinary team. And as near as I can tell, and I don't want to brag too hard, but it appears that we've been a model to other counties that have tried to take up that charge as well. The amendment that you see is an effort to address some concerns by district attorneys in smaller counties especially that have lost a great deal of revenue and are unable, in their view, to even prosecute the most basic of crimes. And to have an unfunded mandate to create an MDT, chair it, and make sure that that goes underway has created, I think, a lack of opportunity for those counties to have the good relationships that we have built in Clackamas County. This amendment is an attempt to allow the district attorney to continue to partner with another agency to ensure that that MDT can get underway if that's their stumbling block, if that's their obstacle, that they just don't have the staff to be the chair of the MDT. We see this as an important partnership with other agencies like DHS and other social service agencies within the county. It has been an extraordinary opportunity and effort in our county to see that cases that, in my view, otherwise were not being prosecuted, were not being investigated, are now, that is now happening, and we'd like to see that continue in other counties. So this amendment simply gives DAs an option that otherwise, those DAs feel that they're overwhelmed with other responsibilities. So I see this as a good thing throughout the state, and I continue to get calls. I got one 2 weeks ago from a county saying, can we borrow your protocol? We want to get up and run. So it's been a long effort, but I think it's going to be a productive one. There's another provision in the Dash 5 amendments that allows for the introduction of financial records into evidence with a certified copy from the custodian of records, acknowledging that those records are, in fact, what the custodian says they are. There's a similar provision for medical records, but what we found as prosecutors is oftentimes defense attorneys perceiving that this might be a weakness in the state's case, having difficulty getting a custodian of records to personally appear in court and say, yes, those are the records that we sent to you. They are what we say they are. They've used that as an opportunity to hold back and not plead as quickly as perhaps they should and admit their guilt. I want to emphasize that there is already a provision in the evidence code that allows for medical records, so this is just going alongside of that. And I think it would save a great deal of expense on the part of the banks who are having to provide someone to come in on the bank's time to testify as to the authenticity of the records. It would save great expense to the state, to the DA's offices who have to sometimes bring custodians in from other states to acknowledge that those are records of their financial institution. This seems to be a win for everyone in terms of just efficiency in the courtroom. One of the other aspects of the Dash 5 amendment that Mr. Greenman talked about is the extension of the elder abuse work group. I'm also in favor of that because I've worked a lot on trying to bring the abuse definitions in line among the different aspects of the Oregon Revised Statutes. They are all over the board, and we have tried to tackle this on a couple of occasions, and it's a daunting task. It's one that I think we need to focus more individualized effort on to get it accomplished. It can be done, but there was just no way in the time that we were given that was a task that we could accomplish right off the top. There's also another provision in the DAS 5 amendments that allows for the repeal of the sunset on the financial records aspect. Detective Smith talked about the medical records side. I want to talk about the financial records. Currently, under the provision that we have, if the detective subpoenas financial records from a bank and asks the bank not to reveal that subpoena to the account holders, that information is kept confidential. The reason that's so critical is that oftentimes perpetrators will join into bank accounts with their victim, and that's their method of getting access to those financial records. So to tip off the perpetrator with notice that the state is looking into financial transactions allows the perpetrator to potentially drain the account or deflect funds to another location, making the investigation even more difficult. So this allows us to do it in a quick and confidential manner so that we can get the investigation done for the benefit of the victim. And then finally, I wanted to reiterate the idea of the CLEs, continuing legal education credits that attorneys would have to take. I'm completely in favor of that. You would be shocked how many attorneys are not aware that they are mandatory reporters. And this is something that I'm glad to see at the bar. It sounds like they're on board with helping us educate attorneys more to that point. And I think the more we can bring to light the prevalence of elder abuse, because I have to tell you, what I'm understanding is that 1 out of 23 incidents of elder abuse is actually reported. So that's very, very low. And if we can just bring that number up somewhat, you can only imagine the number of people that we'd be protecting either financially, emotionally, or physically, or all three all at once. So that concludes my remarks, and if you have any questions, I'm happy to entertain them.
Any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much, John. Representative Dilliam, I would imagine when you first, I don't know if you ever volunteered, if you were assigned to be in this work group, I bet you didn't know how much work you were setting yourself up for.
No, Madam Chair, you tricked me. And, of course, you've seen, the good news is, if you get stuck, if you get the opportunity to be on a task force, I hope you get the kind of team I got, because I've been going to a master's course ever since. Thank you, Madam
Great.
Chair.
Great. It's taken so much work. And for those people, I think, who are new to the legislature, I think we all have good ideas. We think, we should be doing this. I don't think until we get into the weeds we realize how difficult it is and how many wrong turns before you actually reach some conclusions. So I'm happy to see that the work group will continue. Thank you for your work and other people's work on this. And with that, there's nobody else to speak. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2205. And I do look forward to having a work session. Okay, and we will open up House Bill 2781.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2781 has no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact. The statement has not yet been issued. It requires the International Matchmaking Organization doing business in the state to provide personal history and client criminal record, along with information about basic rights to non-citizens, non-resident recruits. It makes a violation punishable by maximum imprisonment of 1 year, a $6,250 fine, or both. It permits action for damages within 2 years of violation or discovery of violation. It authorizes the court to award attorney fees in certain circumstances.
Representative Gelser, welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, State Representative from House District 16, which is Corvallis and Philomath. Thank you for scheduling a hearing on House Bill 2781, and thanks to those who also have signed on to this bill along with me. I wanted to tell you a little bit about where this came from. Last spring, I had the honor to attend a symposium, an international symposium on the trafficking of women that was hosted by the Center for Women Policy and an organization that I'm just blanking on in Japan. And It was a meeting of women from the United States, Japan, South Korea, and the Philippines. And we talked about a variety of ways that women end up moving both as both a part of sex trafficking networks and labor trafficking networks throughout the world. And one of the places that creates very unique vulnerabilities for women is international matchmaking organizations. The less politically correct way to say that is mail order brides. Now, it is certainly conceivable that a woman might go online and try to find a husband in another country, but the fact is that there is not a proliferation of websites where women can go online to find young men in other countries that want to come here to be their husbands. This does primarily tend to be about women. What happens and what makes these women very vulnerable, and there are many people who choose to do this and choose to do this freely. So this bill is not about outlawing these international matchmaking services, but it is about providing really important protections to some women who can be very vulnerable. The reason that these women are vulnerable is that they are leaving behind everyone that they know. Their friends, their family, their culture, their language. They're coming to a country that is completely unknown to them, where they are unaware of their personal rights, where they are unaware of advocacy organizations that are available to them, and may be unable to communicate in the same language. Once they arrive, their food, clothing, shelter, and often their deportation status is reliant upon the person that brought them here, which is now their husband or their fiancé. And so it's very important before these women come to the United States that they know who these people are that are bringing them here, that they are going to marry. And so what this bill does is it ensures that these women have basic, accurate information about these proposed suitors before an introduction is made. And so I'll tell you what it includes. It ensures that women are given, and men too, if it happens to apply to them, information in their native language about domestic violence resources, human rights that are afforded to anyone within the borders of this country, immigration and emergency assistance information, and that would be provided to them by that international matchmaking organization, both before they come, upon their arrival in the United States, and 6 months after the arrival in the United States, at which time problems may have started to occur. It also requires that they provide information to this client or this recruit. So the client is the husband, the recruit is the bride. So the recruit would need to be provided accurate personal history information that would be a declaration made under oath by the client to the International Matchmaking Agency so that the recruit is able to know about the client's marital status. Good idea to know if he's already married before she comes here. The number of previous marriages, annulments, and dissolutions of marriage the client has had in the state or territory of the United States or the country in which the marriage, annulment, or dissolution occurred. Whether any previous marriage occurred after receiving services from an international matchmaking organization. All substantiated allegations of child abuse or neglect against the client, and all protective restraining and stalking orders that have been issued against the client. All orders of court bankruptcy rulings, and any aliases used by the client at the time. In addition, past or current orders for spousal or child support. And this would be information that would be provided to that recruit before her personal information is given to that client. Now, the reason that this is important is that there have been cases in the United States of people kind of cycling through these types of recruits, where they bring one person here and then they go on to the next person, where there's been a history of abuse, of domestic violence, and even actually of homicide in the United States, where people have killed their mail order brides and then moved on and gone and gotten another one. And that actually led to some federal legislation that provides some more limited information. At the federal level, we now provide just a basic criminal background check for these individuals. The other reason that this is important is that some of these women, they come and they can disappear into the labor market, where the women come, again, they're very, very reliant, and they find themselves forced to do work, not just the domestic work. And this is kind of the way that I started to think about it at this
at this conference. This person comes, the client, the husband, has paid a fee for this woman to come, and the expectation may be that her role as a wife that has been ordered is to provide certain domestic, housekeeping, and sexual services that she may not be comfortable with at the time that she gets here. But in addition, what's happened to some of these women is that there's an expectation that they are providing labor services in a restaurant, housekeeping for other people, sexual services for other people that are not the husband, and obviously that is very, very problematic. It's required that this information be provided in language that the person can understand in their native language, and all of this is put on that organization. So it is the International Matchmaking Organization that is making certain assurances to both the client and the recruit that is held accountable for making sure that this good information is given. One other thing that's important to point out, this is about only international matchmaking organizations. We have a very careful definition here. An international matchmaking organization means a corporation, partnership, business, individual, or other legal entity that does business in the United States and offers to residents of the state dating, matrimonial, or social referral services with recruits by providing clients with the personal contact information. But it does not include kind of religious matchmakers within the borders of the United States. It does not include eHarmony or Christian Mingle or Match.com. None of those are the case. It really applies just to those that are charging a fee to bring unmet people from another country here for matrimonial purposes. And I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Any questions? Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you.
The second time that's happened.
Madam Chair. Representative Kenny Gelser. I'm very delighted to see this legislation. Do you have a sense of how many people are brought to Oregon on this? And are there any other states that have this kind of legislation?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Kenny Geyer, thank you for the question. It's very difficult to know the exact number. It's certainly not something that we require reporting about. And this bill actually does not require reporting about that. Washington State does have legislation that's very similar to this. This would bring us into alignment with our neighbor in that regard. I do know that if you kind of go through local newspapers, these cases do pop up. We actually had a case involving these matters in Corvallis several years ago. But I don't have the precise numbers, unfortunately. And that really is the nature of this business, and that is one of the reasons why these women are so vulnerable. We don't know who they are, we don't know where they are, and they don't know how to reach out for help.
Mm-hmm. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for doing this, and I think we all agree that this is something needs addressed. Representative, I have a couple of issues. How did you come up with $1,000? How about the statute of limitations? It's 2 years. And I'm not sure still who's going to enforce this. Most of it, I think, is done on the Internet. Do we have any way of enforcing that?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so this would be required of a business doing business in the state. So they would be, that business would be violating the law. I think one of the challenges is we provide these tools for someone to bring a claim if they violate the law. The challenge is these are very, very difficult organizations to monitor. There are, I went on online actually during our caucus meeting today and apologized to the person sitting next to me because of the things that were popping up on my screen as I started looking for brides in Russia and the Philippines and Japan and other kinds of places. There are many places that you can shop. But the fines and the statute of limitations, that did come from model legislation kind of based on what's happened in Washington.
Madam Chair, follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
But we don't have any way to enforce it. It's just on the Internet, and that's where most of it's happening, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I think the place that we enforce this is when there becomes a complaint. I mean, we're not saying nobody can do this. We are not, and I personally am offended by the idea of going online to buy a woman. We are not outline that in this. What we are saying is that they must provide this information to these women before they provide their contact information. The place that we enforce that is, you know, if a person comes, if they get into trouble, they make the complaint, you go back and you're able to start looking at what is the organization that brought them here and how do we hold them accountable for having provided that information. There may be cases where this information is provided and there still is a problem, but in that case, the benefit is that she now has access to the contact information for who she needs to contact. So I think even if it's difficult to enforce, the benefits of those companies that comply really make the bill worthwhile because we're providing better information to these women before they come and they will be better protected simply by having, it's kind of a buyer beware kind of a thing.
Madam Chair, last kind of thing. I appreciate it and what you're doing, but did Justice weigh in? Will there be a revenue impact or financial impact?
We haven't gotten a or a revenue impact statement yet.
And Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the Department of Justice has raised questions about a couple of other bills that I've had this session. This is not one of them.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative.
Representative Gelser, I'm just curious, is the going rate up in Washington a Class A misdemeanor too?
I'm sorry, I couldn't.
Is it the going rate being a Class A misdemeanor up there in Washington too?
Representative Olson, Chair Tomei, my understanding is yes, we based this off of the model legislation that came out of Washington.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Fixit.
I just have a question because I don't like this either, the idea that people do this. What are men paying for these women? And who do they pay it to?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I anticipated this morning that someone might ask me that question, and that was part of what I was trying to find out. It can be many thousands of dollars. Different organizations may build in different fees. What I saw today, and it really has changed a little bit, even since I first started looking at this a year ago, is that you can sign up for one of these organizations, and you can go on what is called a romance tour. And in going on this romance tour, you will meet, you know, one of the sites today said that on your two-week tour, you would meet and have access to 500 to 1,000 women. And you might have the personal contact information for some of them, and they suggested that maybe you would be able to bring one of them home with you upon your return. But the costs that they outlined would be the fee to the agency, telephone calls. One of them said you need to factor in the cost of, you should probably buy her flowers and dinner, and you should consider that among your costs. It's I assume that we're not working the bill today, but I would urge you, if you want to learn more about this, go on to Google and just, I think you'll be surprised at what you will find.
Sounds more like a marriage counselor.
Representative Whitson?
Follow-up. Do you have cases where the women are working scams on the other side through the agencies so that men send them money, like I've heard this with the Russians, that they'll get really beautiful pictures, and then they have the men send them money overseas through the agencies, but they're part of the agency so that they scam American men out of money for women that don't actually exist, if you will. Have you heard that either, or?
Madam Chair, Representative Whitsett, I believe that this industry is probably full of opportunities for exploiting people on both sides of the issue.
Thank you.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just curious, why isn't this a federal issue? I mean, rather than a state issue? I mean, particularly, I mean, the feds have to issue visas, and the visa has to have some.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos. This actually is a federal issue. In 2005, Congress passed the International Marriage Broker Regulation Act, and that legislation does allow kind of criminal background check information to be provided to individuals. What they are not able to get at, and what is much more difficult to describe at a federal level, are the types of records that we have internally. I mean, we've already seen here in our last bill, the elder abuse bill, even within our state, how difficult it is to compile the different ways that people might be substantiated for abuse. At a state level, what we can do is provide information about child abuse, about restraining orders, about stalking orders. Much more difficult to do that at a federal level.
Follow up? Yeah, so I mean, I probably would echo then Representative Wisnett's question about who would, where, how would we this be enforced? What would be the enforcement body? I mean, I was thinking, well, maybe the state police, but I don't know.
Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos, I believe that part of the enforcement, it becomes a business practice for that business in the way that they operate their business. A requirement for them to operate that business is that they provide this information.
All right. Seeing no one else here to testify, thank you very much for bringing this bill to us, Representative Gelser.
Thank you.
I will close the public hearing and we'll open a work session. We'll carry over the work session on House Bill 2781. Representative Gilliam, we'll wait until the end of the meeting to do that. Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we're going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 3032.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3032 has no revenue impact and it may have a fiscal impact. A statement has not yet been issued. It requires the Department of Human Services to notify the School District, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, and Department of Education of the report of alleged abuse occurring at school.
Seems like that.
Thank you. So we have
the enforcement thing.
Yeah.
Joel Greenberg and Bob Junediff.
Interesting.
Hello.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify today. I'm not sure if this qualifies as a romance tour, but I've always felt that way anyway. House Bill 3032 addresses a much more serious issue.
Sorry, name.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Your name.
Bob Junediff from Disability Rights Oregon. Thank you. The issue comes to you today because of a complaint that our office received having to do with the abuse of a child with disabilities in a school setting and some of the problems that we encountered in assuring that this abusive situation was properly investigated and addressed. And with me today is Attorney Joel Greenberg from Disability Rights Oregon, who's here to tell you about the details of what we experienced and why this piece of legislation would, we think, very neatly address the problem.
Good afternoon, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. Without going into excruciating details, the issue that was uncovered that led us to propose this legislation or back it was that...
your name?
I'm sorry. My name is Joel Greenberg, and as Mr. Junediff said, I am a staff attorney at his organization, Rights Oregon. So when we received this complaint, which actually involved a number of children at a classroom in an Oregon school district, I began an investigation, and I did so, and we took the case because the children involved were of elementary school age between 6 and 8 years old, and they were all extremely vulnerable in the sense that they were cognitively impaired to a huge degree, and they were nonverbal. So these were children who could be abused and would not be able to report it, certainly verbally, and most of them didn't have the cognitive machinery even to indicate that something, the nature of anything that was wrong or bothering them. Nevertheless, what I learned in my own investigation of the situation was that this had been going on for a number of years. It was physical and emotional abuse, not sexual, by the way, and that it involved an aide, an educational assistant in a classroom, and that other aides in the classroom had reported their concerns about the alleged perpetrator to the teacher in charge of the classroom numerous times. Nevertheless, nothing happened. Although there were some meetings, this person continued to work in the classroom and the abuse continued to go on. At least that's what I believe. The investigation report that was given to all of you, I think by email, indicated that none of the folks who I spoke to had either who had either reported or observed the abuse had any reason to doubt the other reporters. They had no reason to doubt the veracity of the reports. Nevertheless, what happened when all of this was reported eventually to the school district administrator above the head of the teacher was that the district, I'm not going to say to my surprise, but very much in keeping with what I would have hoped happened, immediately reported the abuse to the local police force and to DHS. And then they conducted an investigation. Now, while I don't agree with the results of their investigation and haven't been able to see it because of privacy concerns, what I learned about what happened after they reported the their concerns to the local authorities was more disturbing, perhaps, than the abuse itself. And what occurred was that the police force simply looked at whether or not there was sexual abuse and whether or not there were A felonies involved. And when it determined that that was unlikely, did not decide that there was no reason for an investigation or that no abuse had occurred, but decided instead that they did not have resources to investigate further. And I don't question in any kind of serious way that that was reasonable or not. However, they did not report anything to the school district other than that they had declined to investigate. So the school district learned that the police had left the matter uninvestigated. DHS, which was also reported to by the school district, and again very appropriately, was described by the administrator who did the report as absolutely uninterested and requiring arm twisting and sort of a cajoling to even take down the nature of the report. DHS then put out a two-page explanation for why they also declined to do any further investigation. It is my suspicion and an informed suspicion that one of the reasons they declined to investigate was that they thought the matter had been, and they were accurate in this, had been referred to police, but they did not know that the police had declined to investigate further. So we had a situation where there was pretty serious allegation of abuse against very vulnerable children that was reported to two agencies, both of which declined to investigate, neither one of which communicated with the other, so that everyone assumed that someone was looking into this, and in fact, no one except the school district did any kind of investigation until DRO did, and the person of myself. So whether or not you would agree after looking at the report, which I urge you to do, that there was abuse, and I believe there was, it appears very clear that this situation not only did happen, but is very likely to happen again. Because of that, Mr. Junduff and I communicated with pretty extensively Stacey Ayers at DHS to look at whether there was anything that could be done, whether DHS, for instance, would assume primary responsibility for such investigations. DHS, because of resources, is not anxious to assume any new responsibilities, but they were quite clear in agreeing with us that there was a problem, that there was no coordination between the various agencies, and that there was no mechanism for making that kind of coordination happen. The bill you have before you simply is piggybacked onto another one, which requires exactly that kind of coordination and reporting about abuse against children in daycare settings, childcare settings, and simply says the same should occur if there are allegations of abuse in a classroom in Oregon. Absent this bill, that is not going to happen. The extent of the problem, much like the one that was discussed in the bill that Representative Geltzer was just discussing, is unknown because no one tracks this sort of thing, and in the kind of situation that brings me here, no one would know about this unless someone else, in this case myself and my agency, were contacted, and we think that frankly doesn't happen very often. I'm happy to answer questions, as is Mr. June Duff, but I think this is a bill that's needed to make sure this kind of thing doesn't happen again. And absent passage, I think it will happen again.
Thank you. Representative Whitson.
Thank you. Could you give us a definition of what you would consider the abuse and non-sexual abuse? What rises to the level of abuse for, say, emotional or anything that you're talking about, just so we know?
Rather than answer the question with my own definition, I think this bill simply uses the current statutory definitions of abuse that apply to children in a daycare setting. I think it does include physical abuse, it does include sexual abuse, and it does include emotional abuse. Mm-hmm. We're not asking for any change in the definitions or tightening up of them. We're simply saying, let's extend this kind of investigation to one other situation, which is in the classroom.
Follow up?
I'm not familiar with what constitutes emotional abuse in the statute right now or rules. So I'm just asking if you could help enlighten me.
Representative Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, this is, we are, the change to the statute that we're proposing does draw upon the definitions in the child abuse statute, and I'd be very happy to forward those to you. But they are drawn in such a way as to capture the types of situations that the public agency would investigate abuse in the home should it arise. So that being a significant level of abuse that puts the child's safety at risk.
I was just wondering why DHS would refuse to investigate then if there's something in statute already that is definitive, but the example you gave, you said that they refused to investigate. I'm just trying to understand it a little better.
In our discussions with Mr. Ayers, I think what was the most important revelation about that was his statement, which was echoed by others, which was that historically DHS has concentrated on abuse that occurs in the home or in the community. And that was the reason, for instance, that the bill we're piggybacking onto was necessary, because historically, before that passage of that bill, they did not investigate abuse that occurred in child care settings. So that bill expanded it, and we're trying to expand it a bit further. There is no reason that DHS could not investigate such situations, but what they also said, besides historically we didn't do it, is because of that, we're not set up to do it. Our people aren't trained to do that kind of investigation. We think law enforcement should do it. Law enforcement, on the other hand, thinks that because it's not particularly, or it's not necessarily a criminal matter, that DHS should be doing it.
Mr. Greenberg, if I may follow up on that, if the police department was alerted, the DHS was alerted, what would be the point of the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, Department of Education, being alerted if there was no follow-up on the first reportage?
Well, that's another hole in the system and another possible protection. Teacher Standards and Practices immediately launched an investigation when I released and promulgated my report. They said this is a matter that's well within their jurisdiction, and they need to look at whether the teacher, for instance, the educators involved, should be licensed and should be teaching in the kind of classroom they were. That investigation is still ongoing. But without this bill and without something to close these holes, TSPC is not notified when someone reports to the police. TSPC is not notified when someone reports to DHS. And frankly, most people that would be in the position to report this kind of thing, parents, guardians, foster parents, might not realize that Teacher Standards and Practices would be another agency that would be interested in this kind of problem.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So might one of the reasons it would be helpful to report to TSPC be that they may start to see a number of pings on a particular teacher over time, where there are these questions that are being raised?
Yes, that's certainly the hope. I think that's one possible very good outcome. And TSPC may, in fact, revoke or reduce the extent of licensure for the people involved in this particular case. We don't know what's going to happen with that yet. But all of those things are possible. They do keep data. They do have individual files or records on teachers and educators where abuse has been at least alleged, and they would be aware of multiple abuse allegations and hopefully, and I would expect, look more carefully at those folks when subsequent ones came up.
Follow-up?
Just as a general comment, I think that this is a really difficult issue because it's kind of a black hole in terms of who it is that is responsible, and it happens to fall across what is probably the most vulnerable population. You have kids in classrooms that are nonverbal, that are relying on people to be with them behind closed doors, doing catheterizations, doing all sorts of other kinds of things, and they're not able to describe what's happening. I think another example, and it happened, I got this report from a constituent. She had been informed by the school that her child had been her nonverbal child had been the subject of what they believed may have been sexual abuse by another student in the classroom, who made a disclosure to the adults in the classroom that he had touched this other child inappropriately. Because the child was nonverbal, could not tell the mother. Because of confidentiality reasons, they could tell the parent that this may have happened, but they couldn't tell them which child, so the parent couldn't know if they were still inviting this person to the birthday party or whatever else. And because it was considered a student issue, nobody else investigated that outside of the school district. So it's I think that this is an issue very similar to the child care issue that we dealt with a long time ago, that there has to be some way that we have folks going in to do these investigations to protect this group that can't speak up to say, you know, in the case of the Centennial School District, which is the report that was forwarded to us earlier. I mean, the allegation is that this person was taking kids into the bathroom and being instructed to pinch them really hard and hurt them so that they could be sent home for screaming. And there's no way for those kids to explain what has happened. I'd really urge you all to read that report. And it's a real problem that law enforcement said that they didn't have time to investigate and that DHS said it wasn't their responsibility to investigate. That meant nobody investigated, and these kids kept getting hurt, and that's not okay.
Representative Whitson.
So have you talked to TSPC about this? It's my understanding that at least a couple of years ago, they were 2 years behind in their caseload already for what they're dealing with out in the school districts without this issue added into it. Are you talking about hiring more people at TSPC, or how would we deal with an already severely overloaded TSPC?
Representative Tomei, Representative Whitson, thank you for that question. One of the things about this bill that I think is important to notice is that what it's asking for is reporting and communication. And so this bill does not direct TSPC to do anything. What it says is that information should be communicated to them that a complaint has been received. So under this bill, it recognizes that there's two primary investigative agencies, one being DHS that normally investigates child abuse, and one being the police. Now, the problem that we ran into in this instance was that even though there were two investigative agencies, none of them investigated, and neither knew that the other one had chosen not to do so. And so, as with child care agencies, we're asking actually what we believe is a modest step, which is that they just talk to each other. and let each other know if it if that agency is going to step forward and take action in terms of investigating the situation or not. Now, if there are investigative findings, then those investigated findings need to be reported to teacher standards and the Department of Education. Now, why is that? Now, just as in the elder abuse situation that you heard earlier today, in other child abuse situations, in investigations of abuse of mental health and developmental disabilities, those investigations are charged with finding out what happened and making a determination. Was there abuse? Is it unsubstantiated? Is it substantiated? And then once that action is taken, if abuse is substantiated, then there's a requirement to report. And a report goes either to, in all of those situations, either the facility where the person is residing or to a licensing agency if there's a complaint against a professional. And so in this instance, it's completely consistent with how we operate, that if there was a finding of substantiated abuse, that it be reported to the agency that's responsible for licensing and oversight of children. So that is the task that would be put upon us. And in our estimation, we understand all these agencies are very burdened, but if we do have a teacher who is in fact found to be abusing, particularly a child that's nonverbal or unable to protect themselves, that it's appropriate to get that information over to the agency that licenses that teacher.
What is discouraging to me is that the bill says that the Department of Human Services and the law enforcement agency shall jointly determine the roles and responsibilities of the department. In this instance, neither of them did that. So then after they do that part, those lines 22 and 23 of the bill, then they shall each report the outcome of their investigation to the school district. Well, they didn't do an investigation, so nothing would have been reported to the teacher standards and practice. So I understand the issue. I understand the problem. It does. I'm not sure that this addresses that in an adequate way. I mean, I feel very discouraged that neither the police or DHS responded to this, and it was dependent on your agency to have responded.
Chair, if I might, we were also disappointed, but it is our belief, and maybe it's a naive one, that if the two agencies were forced to at least communicate and coordinate what each of them had determined about following up on something like this or not, one of them would have stepped forward, and it's my belief that it would and should have been DHS. We originally looked at legislation which might have just said, DHS, this is your job. I also considered, when I was talking with Mr. Jundeff about how to approach this, and with Mr. Ayers when I was talking to him, what about talking to law enforcement about how to do this? Could they be responsible? And the political issue or the problem there is that law enforcement is a very diverse and widespread community. There are many different jurisdictions. It's hard to even get a meeting where you would have all of law enforcement present and able to respond to something like this. DHS, on the other hand, while overburdened, as Mr. Jundeff indicated, also has some centralized authority and a more centralized mandate, and they seem to be the more, and frankly, their discussion with us indicated that if we had joint responsibility, they would end up doing it most of the time. They said that our experience is that when the responsibility is jointly shared and there's a decision about who does it, law enforcement declines and we do.
And you think that this bill would force the two agencies to confer?
That is the hope, and I believe it would force them to at least confer and communicate, and I think the performance would be better than it was.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gelson.
Thank you. In thinking about this a little bit more, I've had some meetings with Disability Rights Oregon. I've had several conversations with the Department of Human Services about this after that investigation came out from DOJ, and also with the Oregon Department of Education. One of the things that was really concerning to me was that after I sent the DRO report to the Department of Education, the Department of Education staff attorney said, oh my gosh, this triggers my mandatory abuse reporting responsibility. So she called Gresham DHS to make a report, and DHS told the ODE attorney that they didn't accept those kinds of, according to the ODE attorney. So I think there clearly is a lack of communication or a lack of clarity that may not be malintention. I know it's not malintention between the entities. I wonder if we might hold the work session over on this bill, and I would be happy to work with the advocates of the bill and others to see if there's a way to get more closely at that idea of how to get better clarity about who's doing the investigation. I know we had some conversation about OWAPI at DHS.
I have no idea what OWAPI is.
That is the his agency. The adult
and Gilliam's agency,
adult protective.
It's the adult protective services, but they also do special needs children in residential care. That might be a more appropriate entity. These were some of the brainstorms that came up, and maybe we could have another week to see if there might be an appropriate amendment.
That's fine, and this may require that we have a work group that works on this in the interim. Okay, so we're going to be closing. Representative Whitson, can you hold off?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to be closing the hearing on House Bill 3032, and we'll open up a work session on House Bill 3032 and carry over the work session on House Bill 3032.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Now we will open up the public hearing on House Bill 3219.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3219 has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was just issued. It prohibits the finding of unfitness for the purpose of terminating parental rights based solely on emotional illness, mental illness, intellectual or developmental disability, or other disability.
Thank you. Mr. Joondiff, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Representative Tomei. My name is Bob Joondiff, Disability Rights Oregon. House Bill 3219 comes to you today really as an attempt to clarify state law. And it emerges from a number of complaints that we have had in our agency by individuals who have had rulings from courts that have found them to be incapable of continuing to be parents and have taken away their parental rights. And their feelings that the reason that court ruling was made was because those individuals had disabilities, either psychiatric disabilities or developmental disabilities. The law, as we read it, that is ORS 419B504, is somewhat ambiguous on this question. And while we do not have appellate court rulings that would indicate that the state of Oregon, in fact, takes away parental rights solely because of a person's disabilities, we feel that it is incumbent upon the state to make sure that we're very clear that a parent should have an opportunity to parent their child, even if that person has a disability, and if for some reason that disability is so severe that it interferes with their capacity to parent such that it endangers the child, that the state can step forward in those instances. But we would like to see the law be as clear as possible on this question, and we believe that HB 3219 would accomplish that.
Thank you, Bob. Is there anyone else? I think there's nobody else scheduled to hear this. We did get the fiscal, and it has an indeterminate but potentially significant fiscal impact to the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Judicial Department, and the Department of Justice. It might result in increased litigation and termination of parental rights cases. Although the number of cases cannot be predicted at this time, increase in litigation will result in increased attorney general costs, et cetera, et cetera. So you will all get copies of that. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Bob, thanks for being here. Just briefly, obviously in proceedings, modifications or adjustments, temporary suspension of parental responsibilities, could still happen. But you're specifically calling out the termination. Am I on course here of what we're trying to do?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, yes, this particular statute deals with court decisions about termination of parental rights.
And follow up, Madam Chair, what else, if you could just roughly say, what else would be considered? Because obviously the staff summary says solely on emotional illness, mental illness, intellectual developmental disability, and other disability. It leaves open a number of things that a combination of things could result in permanent termination.
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, the statute in question lists a variety of factors that a court is to take into account in making this decision. It's a fairly long list. I don't have it in front of me right now. But one of the things that it does say is that emotional, intellectual, physical disabilities are things that the court should take into account. And as one factor in making that decision. And this piece of legislation would not change that. It would still be matters that a court could take into consideration. The one thing that it would do is say, given all of the factors, that the sole factor for termination should not just be the disability. So it's actually very narrow. So, for example, it would result in a court not being able to say the court determines that this person's parental rights shall be terminated because this person has Down syndrome. There would have to be some link between that disability and the person's ability to parent that was demonstrated. And I'll just add that I, based upon my conversations with attorneys at the Attorney General's office who work in this area, that they believe that that is in fact what happens today. But the law, in our estimation, is not clear on that question.
Thank you.
Representative Wiss,
I'm trying to understand again. So, would you consider any psychiatric disorder that was severe enough to be a sole reason for termination of parental rights? So I'm trying to understand this, and I'm really not quite getting it, but if, say, you had a parent who otherwise appeared okay but perhaps was a manic depressive and to most outward appearances seemed okay most of the time but was very abusive to the child in the home behind closed doors, so do you think that parents should still have the right to have access to that child?
Representative Tomei, Representative Woodson, you actually framed the question very nicely because you have just distinguished between behavior and the disability. Now, if the behavior is that the mother is abusive, that would be the reason in your hypothetical that the person might be at risk of losing their parental rights, not the fact that the person has bipolar disorder. Now, if the bipolar disorder is linked to that behavior or causes that behavior, again, it would not be just because of the bipolar disorder, it would be because of the behavior that is associated with the bipolar disorder. So that is why the word soul is included in the bill. That if there was a court decision that said, for example, we are terminating parental rights because you have bipolar disorder, that would be prohibited by this bill. if there is a decision that said your parental rights are being terminated because of abusive behaviors that are associated with your bipolar disorder, that would not be prohibited by this.
Okay. The key to my question was behind closed doors and small children who it's not evident what's happening to the child in the home with that parent when they are suffering emotional abuse and they're not old enough to say so. How do you then distinguish that they're being abused, you know, if that's going on and they can't say so, but it's very likely that it's going on? I mean, I'm just not able to distinguish here. How do you save those small children who are going to be behind closed doors with a parent that is abusing them emotionally on some level? And, I mean, do we leave them with that parent then and just hope that's not happening just because we don't see it in public?
Representative Tomei, Representative Whitsitt, as of course you know that taking away a person's right to their child is a very, very significant step. And it's one that our laws and our courts require there to be a significant level of proof to demonstrate that a person is incapable of parenting. And that would relate to just about any situation I can imagine. Now, the flip side, I guess, would be to say that if a person receives a diagnosis of some kind or medical evaluation of some type, that there'd be an automatic assumption that that person is unable to parent. And I can think of very few situations, if any, in which that would be the case.
Bob, so do you know of cases where someone's parental rights have been taken away because they do have a mental illness or a disability, intellectual or developmental disability or any other kind of disability?
Representative Tomei, in terms of the complaints that we've received in our office, we haven't gone through the process of investigating in order to make our own determination. Normally, these are situations in which a person has chosen not to appeal a case. They don't have the resources to hire counsel to appeal a parental termination case. This is just a sense that they've been left with. And I would say anecdotally, nationally, yes.
Nationally, yeah.
But that would be anecdotally. I'm not prepared to document that. Certainly historically, that is very definitely mm-hmm. the case, is that we have a tradition historically of relieving people of parental rights because of diagnosed disabilities, be they mental illness or low intelligence or even physical disabilities where, say, a mother is unable to lift a child, and that would be considered grounds to determine that a mother can't give appropriate parenting. I'm not coming to you today with a litany of horror stories, really. This is an effort to make it clear in our state law that that is something that's inappropriate, and that if the state is going to take the extreme step of relieving a person of their parental rights, that it's clear that our law says that that can't be done just because of a diagnosis or a disability, that there needs to be some evidence of behaviors or harm that a child has suffered.
Thank you, Bob. Any further questions? Representative,
thank you.
Kennedy.
Madam Chair, just wondering again where we stand vis-a-vis other states in terms of this kind of legislation.
Representative Tomei, Representative Kenny Geyer. Actually, the people who brought this to me gave me examples from other states mm-hmm. that have written language into their laws. And again, in the spirit of trying to be as clear as possible, I'm aware of eight other states that have language specific to clarify again. Now, my assumption is that most states would not their case law would probably not support removal of parental rights just based upon a diagnosis or disability. Mm-hmm. But I don't have that information for you.
But so we're not going to be moving this bill today. I know you've got some more questions, and I might suggest that maybe you might want to contact Mr. Judith, but I'll entertain one more.
Okay,
go ahead.
Thank you very much. I just wanted on the record. My concern is for small children here, and I wonder, since federal government considers untreated alcoholism and drug addiction a disability, do you consider untreated alcoholism or drug addiction a disability for this bill?
Representative Tomei, Representative Witsa, actually the federal law does not term untreated alcoholism or drug abuse to be a disability. What it does do, however, is that it says that if a person is an alcoholic or has a history of drug abuse that is not active, that is indeed a disability. And so under the Americans with Disabilities Act, a person is not supposed to be discriminated against essentially because of a past history of addiction. And so, for example, if a person goes to AA meetings and says, I am an alcoholic, but has not used in 20 years, for example, that person could be considered to be to have a disability. And again, this bill would say that because of a person who is in that situation, has that characteristic, that their parental rights could not be terminated solely because they're an alcoholic is in that posture.
So is the answer yes or no? If they're an alcoholic or drug addict, do they fall under the definition in this bill?
And again, Representative Whitsitt, if they're the Americans with Disability Act does not protect active use of alcohol and drugs, and so it does not protect anyone who is actively using alcohol and drugs. What it does do, a disability is a person who has an alcohol or drug dependence that is not active.
So is your bill cover it? Let's leave the feds out of it then.
Yeah, well,
do you consider for this bill, for
yes,
the purposes
for
this bill?
For this bill, the fact that a person is an alcoholic who is not presently using alcohol, that person would be protected from having their parental rights terminated solely because they are an alcoholic who is not presently using alcohol.
So if that parent were abusing or neglecting their child, then that might be a reason for them to
absolutely
have termination.
This does not protect any behavior that is harmful to a child.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. And no one else has signed up. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3219, open up work session on House Bill 3219, and close the work session on House Bill 3219. I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2205. Representative Gilliam.
Chair Tremay, I move to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated April 5th, 2013, to House Bill 2205.
Representative Gilliam moves to adopt the Dash 5 amendments dated 12-15-13 on House Bill 2205. Any discussion? We're not moving the bill today, but the representative asked if we could move in the Dash 5 amendments, which I'm hoping we can do today. Any discussion or questions? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted, and I close the work session on House Bill 2205 and carry over the work session on House Bill 2205.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, I would move to suspend the rules on House Bill 3301 and reopen it for work session to allow Representative Gelser and Representative Wisnett to vote.
Wisnett, okay. I open up House Bill 3301, and Representative Olson has moved that we allow Representative Wisnett and Gelser vote on this bill. Any objection? Seeing none? Representative Gelser, how do you vote? Gelser votes aye. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry I had another meeting, and I worked on this bill for about a week with Representative Barnhart. I think I have all the inputs and that the amendment addressed, because there was concern from the Homeowner Association at Sun River, and I also contacted Black Butte and Eagle Crest, and we also contacted the person in charge, the lawyer that works Homeowner Association, and they feel they're comfortable with the amendment that you passed into the bill, too.
Great. So
I hope that satisfies all the concerns, and I'll vote yes.
Thank you, Representative. What's it? Wisnant votes yes. Gee whiz. Okay, and I close the work session on 3301, and I close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing.
About time. Ooh.